Let's take a second and talk about something nice and slow. I'm talking about In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. This is written by Carl Honoré. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's H-O-N-O-R-E with a accent mark. I believe he's French-Canadian. And I read this book because it came by way, I think, of a mention in a New Yorker article, I think, that had made mention of this. This book is... We could probably say that this book is more of a critique on capitalism than a lot of things, as a lot of these sort of topics are. The title of the book is much more literal than I expected it to be, at least the subtitle of it, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. And it is about the actual movement of slowness. And it starts with the slow food revolution. And then each of the 10 chapters in here deal with one facet of human life. It's things like food, cities, the mind and the body, medicine, sex, work, leisure, and children. And as I was reading through this, I was really hopeful that this was going to be super applicable in ways that I can incorporate various new techniques and things in my life that might help me feel better about one thing or another. And this book just really was not that. I wish that it was. And I think that now that I've gone through and I've read some reviews in the book from around the web, I think that, yeah, this probably was... A little outside the realm of what I thought it was supposed to be. As I was reading the book, I sort of made my own list of things that I would do. And I'll get to that at the end here. But I will mention that this book was written, I think, in 2004. I think it was published in 2005, thereabouts. So this was a couple of years prior to the iPhone introduction. Blackberries were certainly a thing. The book doesn't feel super dated to me, although there are points where it comes across as a little out of date. For example, it does make mention of Blackberries, and I think MTV is mentioned a time or two in here, but it's kind of, it holds up well enough. The author of this book, I think, meant well. I think that they were sincere about documenting what they were coming across and what they were experiencing. And as the introductory chapter summarizes, the author was sort of turned to this notion when they realized that they could get children's stories in a fraction of the time. That was the thing that drove him to recognize, now, wait a minute, something's gone horribly wrong if we're all trying to sort of speed through our children's bedtime stories. And I get, again, that he's a Canadian journalist, and so the book is written as if it was a journalistic piece. There is a lot of a volume of numbers and statistics about, like, in Italy, they do this, and in North Korea, they do that, and in South Korea, they do this. And then in the Chinese, this movement's doing this, and this group of people over here has this amount of support, and, this growing movement has number of people in it, whatever. The takeaway for me is that this book will frustrate the heck out of Americans because it frustrated the heck out of me. If you live in the United States, a lot of the things in this book are just not for you. And I get that it's a Western culture sort of thing, but even, and the author does do a very good job, I will admit, of sourcing numbers and of all the volume of data that he's sourcing from lots of different places and lots of different countries and cultures. And a lot of it comes from the European Union. And I think I speak for a lot of Americans when I say that whatever it is the European Union is doing, we are so far behind and whatever it is that they're thinking about. I mean, to give you one example, he talked a lot about mandatory legislation and policies on maximum amount of work in a week, and goes into much more detail in a portion about the French, who have much stronger laws than this than the EU does. But this is so far off the radar of what anybody in the United States is thinking about. Our United States Congress is nowhere near doing anything like this. And so a lot of this stuff will just sort of make you irritated because you recognize that there is nothing that you can do about any of it. And that's kind of my takeaway on it, is that I just felt powerless which makes it a little bit sad. It's a very informative book. I wouldn't call it any other emotion other than that. It is just straight up data dump after data dump of things that people are doing. I will say I made a few notes along the way, not that many actually compared to my usual. It's not even that quick of a read, really. It's about 250 pages or so, 270 pages. I skipped a couple of chapters. I didn't read the portion about children, for example. He actually has a follow-up book that's entirely about raising children in sort of a slow, methodical way. And it's not so much about trying to do anything like raise children or eat with the purpose of making it slow, as in like physically slowing down the movements of things, although that's part of it. It's also about sort of changing our culture around some things. And so there was a segment here in the introduction, which was titled "Do Everything Faster," that I made a note of. And he writes, "Speed triggers the release of two chemicals, epinephrine and norepinephrine." Let me see if I can't get over this. Norepinephrine. There we go. We learned a new word today. Epinephrine and norepinephrine that also course through the body during sex. Kundera is right on the money when he talks about the ecstasy of speed. And then in context here, Kundera was a person that he was talking about who was a philosopher that he's citing. He says, "And not only do we enjoy going fast, we get used to it. We become velocitized. When we first drive onto a motorway, 70 miles per hour seems fast. Then after a few minutes, it feels routine. Pull onto a slip road, brake to 30 miles per hour, and the lower speed seems teeth gnashingly slow. Velocination fuels a constant need for more speed. And as we get used to 70 miles per hour, we're tempted to lean a little bit harder on the accelerator to push the speedometer up to 80 miles per hour or 90 miles per hour or higher. In 1899, a Belgian engineer built the first car designed purely to break speed records. Shaped like a torpedo and propelled by two electric motors, the vehicle bore a name that summed up our yearning to go faster and faster. The Never Happy." And he says, "The curse of velocitation reaches beyond the open road. Take web surfing. We're never happy with the speed of our internet connection. When I first began surfing the net with a broadband modem, it seemed lightning fast. Now it seems run of the mill, even a little sluggish. When a page fails to load instantly, I lose patience. Even a delay of 2 or 3 seconds is enough to make me click the mouse to hurry things along. The only answer seems to be a faster connection." I will pause here to say, in my own personal assessment of this, this is one of those points where the book feels a little dated at this point in 2022, because quite frankly, I don't know that any people are really sitting around that have true high-speed internet connections. If you've got broadband of like 300 megabits per second or faster, or even 100 megabits per second or faster, I don't think a lot of people are sitting around complaining about the speed of web pages, certainly. I don't even know that people with like LTE and increasingly 5G connections sit around and complaining about the speed of things. It's been a long time since I've heard someone complain about a slow web page on an LTE connection that wasn't related to some sort of server issue where it was malfunctioning. But anyway, he says, "As we go on accelerating, our relationship with time grows ever more fraught and dysfunctional. Any medical textbook will tell you that a microscopic obsession with detail is a classic symptom of neurosis, the relentless drive to shave time into ever smaller pieces. It takes 500 million nanoseconds to snap your fingers, by the way. Makes us more aware of its passage, more eager to make the most of it, and makes us more neurotic." And he goes on to talk about how the value of time has changed and gives sort of a historical analysis of things from the Gutenberg Bible all the way up to, you know, today's modern Blackberries in his parlance, pagers in the internet. But he also says here at the bottom of this little introductory section, this is what I was trying to get to. "Some argue that a round-the-clock culture can make people feel less hurried by giving them the freedom to work and run errands whenever they want to. That is wishful thinking. Once the boundaries are swept away, competition, greed, and fear encourage us to apply the time is money principle to every single moment of the day and night. This is why even sleep is no longer a haven from haste. Millions study for exam, learn foreign languages, and brush up on management techniques by listening to tapes while they doze. On the sleep learning website, the assault on what used to be one of the time that we could slow down without feeling guilty is dressed up as an exciting opportunity for self-improvement. Quote, your non-waking hours, one third of your life, are now non-productive. Tap this huge potential for advancing your career, health, and happiness." I agree that this is the sort of thing that is definitely problematic for just about anybody and everybody, even if you are one of those people that seems to be a productivity demon and that you're always sort of looking to shave a time trial here or there, or make something go a little bit faster. You know, I get it, but I think that we can all recognize that it's not healthy, it's not great, and it's not really doing much of anything for us. I think that the issue that I take with most of this is that while it's balanced and generally seems to come from a useful place of intention in his heart, I don't know that I don't know that it allows for people to do much other than understand there are some people in this world who get to do things that you don't. And one of those might be being able to spend 4 hours on dinner. He talks a little bit about this in a section about food. This is what sort of kicked off this whole thing for him, is slow food, which was probably the most, it was the first of these slow movements. He goes into other things like Tantra, for example, about slow sex and other sorts of stuff in the book. But food takes up a good portion of this. And for obvious reason that we all know this to be true, that if you cook your own food, it will generally be healthier for you than if you buy something from a fast food joint or something that's in a box or some sort of prepared or pre-processed meat or TV dinner or meal of some kind. The problem, though, is that this doesn't really do a lot for anybody who's not privileged enough to be able to work in a position that allows them either the money to be able to afford some of these things or the time to be able to prepare a lot of these meals. And I'm usually in agreement that most people, most of the time, with the exception of the extreme poor, can find time for the things they want to find time for. We see people, there are obviously clearly people, professional people who can, for example, go to the gym, eat well, and raise kids and do them fine, right? And, or at least do them well and get results from those things that are meaningful and impactful to them. And so when you hear people say, I don't have time for exercise, for as an example, it sort of falls on a little bit of a deaf ears to me, because I recognize that, yes, that's not necessarily untrue. I just don't know that I believe you in that context, because I know that it is possible. And if, assuming, again, that that person is not encumbered by some, you know, extreme level of poverty, or they have to work three jobs, or they're going to, I don't know, night school or something like that, more often than not, they can find the time. They just need to take it away from something else, right? Like maybe you have a little bit less Netflix time and a little bit more time to sit at the dinner table and be with your spouse, for example. I'm not saying that everybody can do that. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on people. I'm just saying that this book actually comes across a little bit like that, to the extent that it doesn't seem to take into account that, yeah, you got to be kind of a privileged person to be able to have the luxury of being able to do this. However, he does come across and reckon that, there are people that, you know, will have some struggle with this, and that, yes, the price of health in many cases is what we pay for, you know, better quality food, and that those things are directly related. Anyway, there was a segment here that I bookmarked because it really sort of sums up probably the worst kind of attitude of this book, where he says, when he's talking about eating at a cafe in Italy, he says, the wine comes swiftly and is exquisite, fresh and light. Then a plate of mixed antipasti arrives. It is a delightful medley, a tiny pizza, a sliver of asparagus torte, zucchini stuffed with egg, mortadella, parmesan, potato, and parsley. Arranged in a small pile in the center of the plate are the jewels in the crown, baby onions or cipollini, roasted with vinegar. They are ambrosia, firm and yielding, sweet and tangy. My father picked them in the garden this morning, says the chef en route to another table. Despite our hunger, we eat slowly, savoring every mouthful. All around us, wine flows, aromas waft, laughter dances on the cool evening air. A dozen conversations blur into a low, sweet, symphonic hum. Yeah, I know. I get it. This book is very heavy on making you think or imagine what life would be like if you could somehow apply some of the principles of slowness that they talk about. Again, don't think that his heart is in the wrong spot there. Don't even think that his mind is in the wrong spot there. I just think that the attitude about it misses the mark for a lot of people in more practical realities. So, and then continuing on with the food, he says, when it comes to modifying our own behavior, slow food is realistic. It recognizes that every meal cannot be a four-hour banquet of handmade delicacies. The modern world simply does not allow it. We live in fast times, and taking a fast approach to food is often the only option. Sometimes all we want or need is a sandwich on the run. Yet it is possible to work some of the slow food ideas that inform the menu at our own kitchens. The place to start is with the raw materials, local seasonal produce, meat, cheese, and bread from conscientious producers, maybe even a few herbs like mint, parsley, and thyme grown in the garden or on the balcony. The next step is to cook more. After a long, bruising day at work, our reflex is to throw a ready-made meal in the microwave or call out for Thai food. But sometimes that reflex is just that, a reflex. It can be overcome. We can find the time and energy to do a little chopping, frying, and boiling. In my experience, taking a deep breath and just heading into the kitchen can be enough to get over the I can't be bothered to cook hump. And once there, the payoff is more than gastronomic. As the crushed garlic slides into the pan of hot oil and starts to sizzle, I can feel the stress of the day melting away. Again, I like that chunk of it. I think that I've highlighted these two pieces because I think they sort of show the worst and the best of this book. Where he's talking about food, which is something that is applicable to everybody, and we all sort of have that situation about us. I just don't know that, again, I just don't know that it's necessarily realistic for all the people all the time. I appreciate the sentiment of it. I just wish that there was something, a little more practical about it, right? I think it's one thing to say, I'm going to go write a book and I'm going to write about slow food and I'm going to go to Italy to do it. That's fine. It started in Italy, that whole movement. And so that makes a lot of sense. And what doesn't make a lot of sense is that, okay, now that you've been at the cafes in Italy, how about you come to, I don't know, someplace in Chicago? Or why don't you fly out to some, you know, farmstead in Omaha and tell me about how they apply the principles of slow food when, you know, they've got life circumstances that are sort of stacking up against them in highly stressful ways. Because what goes unsaid here is this notion that you should just be able to cook, right? And that for a lot of people, the ability to cook is not necessarily built in, and that the inability to cook or the inability to cook well means that you might waste ingredients. It means that you actually might make things that don't taste very good at all. And then I think in a lot of cases, increasingly, that a lot of people buy prepared meals precisely because they don't know how to prepare their own food. That's tragic in one way or another, but we can't forget about those people. And we also can't shame those people because they don't know what they don't know, right? And I think there's even a lot of people who know they don't know how to cook and they don't cook precisely because they don't know how. What we're saying, though, is that in this movement that you should cook your own food is a bit like saying you should just go learn to play the guitar, right? Or go learn how to juggle or go learn how to do some other task that may seem innate. It may seem important or critical, like changing the tire on your car or changing the oil in your car or something like that. But that just a lot of people don't know how to do. That generally speaking, the specialization of a lot of the things in our world have made this so much more cumbersome than they used to. He writes about cities as well. And I will say that in discussion about cities, I have a lot of opinions about this sort of thing. I wish that there was more that an individual person could do. It's not always the case, though. I wanted to pull out one thing because he mentions and quotes a lot of people from times long ago. And I think he does this with the intent of saying that this is part of our human story. This is part of history, that even people in the 1950s, the 1900s, the 1880s, the 1500s, in some cases, the monks, the popes have challenged these issues and problems before. And that as time goes on, the problems that we've had have always been the sort of problems that we've always had. and that we just deal with them in different ways. But I wanted to read this little bit here. He says, in chapter one, I described the city as a giant particle accelerator. That metaphor has never been more apt than it is today. Everything about urban life, the cacophony, the cars, the crowds, the consumerism, invites us to rush rather than relax, reflect, or reach out to people. The city keeps us in motion, switched on, constantly in search of the next stimulus. Even as they thrill us, though, we find cities alienating. Not long ago, a poll found that 25% of Britons do not even know their neighbors' names. Side note from me here, that number is actually about double in the United States. I wouldn't be surprised if that number is not closer to about two-thirds in the United States now. He writes, disillusionment with urban life goes back a long way. In 1819, Percy Bysshe Shelley observed, quote, hell is a city much like London. A few decades later, Charles Dickens chronicled the squalid underbelly of the fast-growing, fast-paced cities of industrialized Britain. In 1915, Booth Tarkington, a Pulitzer-winning American novelist, blamed urbanization for turning his native Indianapolis into an impatient inferno. Not quite so long ago as a generation, there were no painting giant here, no heavy, grimy city. There was no time to live. Throughout the 19th century, people looked for ways to escape the tyranny of the town. Some, like the American transcendentalists, moved to remote corners of the countryside. Others made do with occasional bursts of back-to-nature tourism. But cities were here to stay, and so campaigners sought to make them more livable with reforms that echo today. One measure was to import the slow, soothing rhythms of nature by building public parks. Central Park in New York City is one example that he cites here, as well as others. These things are all fine and well. Again, I think most Americans that live in very rural or even sort of remote suburban, semi-urban places are going to find that to be a little off-putting because there's just something that we just don't do in this country, it seems like. We just don't have really good, equitable parks in a lot of places, which is a shame. But again, this is one of those reasons why this book will make a lot of Americans sort of gnash their teeth at it all. Later on in the book, he talks about the mind and the body, and he makes this remark that I had never heard from Einstein, is what he quoted here. He says, Einstein appreciated the need to marry two modes of thought. Quote, computers are incredibly fast, accurate, and stupid. Human beings are incredibly slow, inaccurate, and brilliant. Together, they are powerful beyond imagination. And that is why the smartest, most creative people know when to let the mind wander and when to knuckle down to do hard work. In other words, when to be slow and when to be fast. This was similar to a book that I believe Malcolm Gladwell had blurbed at one point about thinking fast and slow, about how we can apply the principles of slowing down to think about what it is that we're doing before we do something. I think we all instinctively know this from all the years that people have been telling us that you should always plan and prepare. And that part of that planning and preparation is just thinking about what it is that you're doing. But then he goes on, and this is sort of where the book starts to lose me a little bit. He goes on to talk a lot about meditation and about how it's gone mainstream and how a lot of Americans are doing it and that, you know, it's good and you know that it works because insurance companies are covering it and so forth and so on. He talks about how Britain's National Health Service covers these sorts of things and because they're always cash strapped. And again, another one of those circumstances that will make Americans sort of gnash their teeth. It's like, well, if you want to talk about medical care, let me talk to you about our insurance programs here in this country. But he goes on and on about how meditation can help people. I've heard a lot of this stuff before. There's nothing in this section that particularly comes to me as something new that I hadn't heard before or that I didn't instinctively already know. I think a lot of people, if you said, hey, what would you like to do just to, you know, improve your life? I think most anybody would say, yeah, I'd like to be able to eat better. I'd like to be able to exercise more. Meditation sounds kind of nice in some capacity or another. I'd like to be able to, you know, cook my food with my family and spend more time with them or with my spouse or with my friends. I'd like to be able to slow down and think about things more. We'd all like to be able to do those sorts of things. And yet the culture just does not allow us to do those sorts of things. And I don't know how to change those sorts of things. And I don't know that this book gives any ideas about how to do that sort of stuff either. which is a shame because I feel like if he had just gone a little bit deeper in some of these sections, that it would have worked, that this book would have been a better story. Lastly, there was a section towards the end of the book here about the benefits of working less hard. And again, I think we can all recognize academically that, yes, there are lots of reasons why working less hard would make us all more productive or smarter or more efficient. I think we also know, and as he cites in the book repeatedly, the nations that have the highest level of productivity aren't the ones that have the highest amount of working hours. That he cites Britain as an example as having the lowest per worker productivity in the EU. What I think goes unsaid, though, is that I think America skews this. I think America actually does have a pretty high per worker productivity rate, despite the fact that we work a lot too. So I don't know that these things are necessarily one-to-one in their approach. But he writes in here about how many people would turn to a pay cut if they could save a little bit of time. Right? Like if your boss told you, it's like, hey, would you like to work less and in exchange take a pay cut? How many people would want to do that? And he says that, the Royal Bank of Canada has also won plaudits for recognizing that its employees have lives outside the office. On any given day, up to 40% of RBC staff will be using a work-life program. Job sharing, flexible time, reduced hours, at the bank's headquarters, a gleaming skyscraper in downtown Toronto. There I meet Karen Domartsky and Susan Lieberman, a couple of smart, energetic 40-somethings who have moved steadily up the ranks since starting to share a job in 1997. By 2002, the pair were second in command of the division that sells banking services overseas. We meet on a Wednesday, the only day of the week when they overlap at work. Their shared office is homey. On two shelves stand a forest of family photos, artwork by their children hang on the wall. Both women follow a similar career path. After earning MBAs, they both begin climbing the corporate ladder, putting in 60-hour weeks without blinking. But once children entered the picture, they have three apiece, life became an endless, unsatisfying rush. So they decided to share a job, doing 3 days a week each. Again, this is sort of the unrealistic expectations of these sorts of things. Good luck walking into wherever it is that you work this week and telling your employer or your manager or even yourself, if you are a freelancer, you know what? Let's just share a job with me and one other person. I just don't know how that. Yeah, let me know how that works out for you. He goes on to say that the 40% pay cut turned out to be less of a blow than it sounds. It helps, of course, that both of them have high-earning husbands. Oh, I bet it does help. Both women are able to spend more time with their children, making family life more relaxed and rewarding. Newsflash, if you work less or are largely unemployed for a good portion of the time, you can do other things with that time. Again, I think that represents maybe some of the worst of this book. I gave it about 2 stars. A 2.75 would be sort of my final rating on it. There's a follow-up that's about parenting and raising children in sort of a slow fashion. I don't know that a person will get a lot of out of this book unless you've just never heard of any of it. If you've never heard of the value of sort of slowing down and thinking about what it is that you're doing, maybe this will be the best book for you to start with. I don't know. I actually think that it's a lot like, it touches on a book that I read last year that I really liked called The Blue Zones of Happiness, which was about research studies in various places across the world, including the United States, where people applied different behaviors in mass that allowed them to do some of the things that this particular book talks about, which is eating better, spending more time with family and friends, having lower stress because you've reduced your workload and those sorts of things. That would be a much better book to read if you were interested in this sort of thing, because Blue Zones of Happiness is one of those books that I actually gave 5 stars to last year. It came by recommendation of a friend. The book is by Dan Buettner, B-U-E-T-T-N-E-R. And I highly recommend it as a better primer on sort of how to readjust your life into things. But I mentioned at the start of the show, I said that there would be, I had a list of things that I had put together about what I would do if I wanted to really apply the principles of slow living, which I think is something that I've been thinking about a lot over the years, to my life. And what would I do to really slow down? Well, one of the things that I would do is I would cancel Amazon Prime. And I would cancel it because for two reasons. One is that Amazon, by and large, isn't necessarily a great company, that the prices reflect a dislocated reality of what things actually cost. And so, yeah, that book might be $5 more expensive someplace else, but that $5 more is the cost of not having somebody that has to work in an Amazon warehouse, right? But the other benefit and purpose for a slow life is that it just slows down your ability to get stuff. And that if you have less stuff, that you don't just quickly spin off and be like, oh, I guess I need, you know, five more screwdrivers or whatever. If you make it a little bit more challenging to get some of that stuff, that you might actually slow the consumerism that so easily shows up on our doorsteps. What else would I do? I would time block. This is something that I actually do practice. I set time on my calendar in blocks, and I say, you know, between 9 and 10:30 a.m., I'm going to work on this report, right? And that's the time that I've given for it. And what I generally find is that, as time has gone on, I've gotten much better about estimating how long something is going to take and budgeting my time more wisely. But I also know that sometimes having that sort of artificial self-imposed deadline allows me to move quickly on things in an efficient way that keeps me on task. And while it's not necessarily a slow strategy, it does help with monotasking. It helps me sort of stay on task by preventing me from moving around between other things. And I take it seriously enough that I silence my phone and do other measures to not check my email and these sorts of things, but to actually focus on the task at hand. And because I'm actually much more deeply involved in the process at hand, I tend to be more efficient at it. It saves me time, which allows me more time to do something else. What else would I do? I'd read an actual newspaper. This has been a bit of a struggle for me because I don't have the ability to get a newspaper delivered to me at my house. Nor would I necessarily think that it's a bad thing environmentally, but if I could, I would get a really good national paper like the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or something delivered to my house. But none of those options are available to me, so I'm sort of left with the web for that. And if you're like me, and that idea appeals to you in some way, so that way you don't spend all day glued to Twitter or reading, you know, as they happen, news updates that more than likely aren't accurate or aren't fact-checked, then you set yourself the standard to get up, look at the news, and then walk away. Like when you sit down to have breakfast in the morning or something, if you're by yourself and you're not having it with your kids or your family, I take that time to read the news. It's the one time that I read the news during the day, and then I don't look at it anymore until the next day. And I got to tell you, that is really great for your mental health. Highly recommend that. To add to that, no social media. Social media is not part of a slow anything. My relationship with social media is much more professional than it used to be. I pop in for the one or two things that I need. Occasionally, there's a Facebook group that I just kind of have to get sucked into because it's the only way that some group or organization communicates with the outside world, in which case I go straight to it. I look at what I need. I close the tab and move on. And more often than not, I actually don't allow myself to stay logged in to any of my social media accounts. I don't have any of the apps on my phone. People that message me have learned pretty quickly that Messenger on Facebook is not a great way to do it. And so people email me or they text me, which is my preference on that. So same with email. If I wanted to encourage people to have more of a slow, methodical relationship with their day, check your email twice, three times a day maximum. Set some times that are consistent for that. Like tell yourself, I'm going to check my email at 9:30, maybe at 1 o'clock, and again at 3:30 in the afternoon, right? And as you're checking it, like make that the time block it for half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour or whatever to sit down and just deal with the messages in your inbox and make those replies sort things out, get things out of your inbox. Don't use your inbox as a to-do system. Get them out into a project management system of some sort, like Trello or Basecamp, like what I use, for example. Don't leave them sitting in your email. What else would I do? I would sleep when I'm drowsy and not necessarily when I'm tired. And so what I mean by this is that I think a lot of people, when you ask them, you know, how are you? And they say, oh, I'm tired. It's like, well, there's a difference between tired and drowsy, right? Like there's the tired we feel because we just kind of want a break. And there's the tired that we feel because we're drowsy and we actually need to sleep. And if I could figure out a way to do it that would be very routine, and I think I'm kind of close to this, I would just sleep when I'm drowsy and I would wake up when I wake up. And I kind of do that already. And the end result is that I end up going to sleep more often than not at rotations based on the sun. I get it because I don't have kids and I don't have sort of these outside forces that are working on me, like school schedules and stuff, that in the winter I end up getting sleepier and go to bed earlier and then I wake up later. I kind of hibernate in a way often because I just don't want to wake up and it's because it's cold in the morning. But if you could get yourself to a point where you slept when you were sleepy and you woke up when you woke up and you didn't blow it, right? Like you don't wake up and you're like, oh, I just kind of don't want to face the day. And so then you lay there for 3 more hours. Like that's not great. But if you could sort of get yourself onto that pattern, that'd be great. I'd say the same thing about eating. Eat when you're hungry and don't eat when you're not hungry. What else would I do to really slow down? And this is one that I have done and most people will just sort of blow their minds at. You wouldn't have a car. Nothing about traveling in a car embraces the slow life at all. In fact, if you wanted to live, a more slow, methodical, appreciative, deep life, you got to get rid of your car. And that might mean some dramatic changes for some people in some places, right? Some of you may not be able to cut that at all, right? Like maybe you just live out in the middle of nowhere and there's just no other way, right? But if you're in a city that has even semi-decent public transit, or you could move to some place that has semi-decent public transit, then that's going to be the way that you get around, right? Bicycling, walking, it changes your perception of a lot of cities, particularly a lot of large American cities that sprawl to the extent that they do. There'll be parts of, you know, people will be like, hey, we're going to go to this place across town. You'll be like, you know what? I am not going to go there. I am not going to spend 2 hours bouncing across town just so I can go to like a, I don't know, the Chinese buffet up there that's close to your house. It's just not sustainable for the environment. There is no future, none. There is no future where any country hits its carbon goals or that we make any measurable change for the better in any environmental impact that involves people in their cars. None. Like in order for there to be any useful, measurable impact in favor of the environment, people have to stop driving so much. Full stop, period. Short of potentially having dramatic changes in our car technology, which I don't foresee happening in the next 5 years. I think that people have got to change that. What else would I do? I would embrace artisans and the cost associated with those things. So if I bought a loaf of bread, can I buy it from a bakery that sells the bread versus, you know, the thing in the bag at the Kroger? If you can do that and it costs you an extra 75 cents, then pay the extra 75 cents, right? Eat seasonally, including meat. The book touches on this a little bit too, about, how our culture has been able to give us strawberries and tomatoes all year round, despite the fact they don't taste very good and they don't really taste like anything. I would embrace the seasonality of things more. This is something that I'm trying to think about and work on myself. It's hard, particularly in the Midwest in the winter, because I don't want to live off of nothing but corn. I don't know. There's not a whole lot of seasonality to a lot of things in a lot of places. It's like, actually, I think we probably would have all moved. We probably would have all moved someplace south if people had lived here, if like caveman times or something. So, you know, there's a limit to that, but I get the sentiment behind it to eat things that are at least slightly more seasonal. This includes meat too. One of the things that I've learned over the years is that meat has a season to it. By and large, we don't, you don't slaughter cattle, for example, in the winter. You slaughter them towards the end of the summer, and that's when you have cattle. Pigs, I think, are in the spring because they fatten up over the winter, I think. I could be wrong about that. I'm not a farmer, so don't take my advice on that too closely. But it, you know, there are seasons to these things that we probably shouldn't be able to have ground beef all year round, constantly in every place. What else would I do that you can do too? Leave your phone someplace. Do things like, you know, put your phone upstairs on your bedroom nightstand, or put it in your office, or put it in the foyer, or put it in a bowl in the kitchen, or something like that. And that's just where your phone is. Treat it sort of like we all used to back when they were wired and hung on the wall. that's where the phone is. And when you walk away from it, that's where your phone isn't. You can do other things with your phone as well. A lot of people view these sorts of things as tricks, but I find them useful. Delete the apps that you know just aren't cutting it for you. This is mostly social media junk. Keep the screen notifications to a useful limit. Use your app library on the iPhone. Don't have such a big stream of just little bright icons on your face all the time. My phone has one screen and half of it's taken up by a weather widget. So there's not a whole lot else to look at on there. There's not a lot for me to check on my phone. It removes the little dopamine hit that you get when you're always trying to think, oh, do I have a new message? Do I have a new something? More often than not, I don't. And then what else would I do? I'd eat slower, cook all my meals, and avoid eating alone where possible. And this has been frustrating for me. It actually makes me a little sad sometimes when I think about it. I've actually been trying to improve the way that I eat to the extent that I'm not doing it alone all the time. I want to make sure that I'm inviting people someplace, even if I have to go someplace and have lunch with them, invite people over for dinner, cook for other people. The problem is that nobody seems to want to do that. I invite people and then sometimes I just kind of get radio silence on that. I don't know that it's necessarily their fault. COVID obviously is a valid concern, but in places where it's safe to do so, or at times it's been safe to do so over the last year or so and in the future, that hasn't worked out incredibly well for me. But it's something that I continue to work on and hope to sort of nudge people over, into taking part in that with me. Anyway, the book is In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed by Carl Honoré. Give it about 2.5 stars. And I don't know that it's the best book that I've read on this topic, but it's not the worst either. Very data heavy, not very American centric, to the extent that for Americans, it just may seem a little otherworldly. But if you're in the EU, probably an excellent book to read.